situation. LaRouche is a very phenomenal guy, but in terms of organizing a whole population, you need an army. You need a youth movement. The youth nudge that the old people are useless, far from that, but there's a certain responsibility that is on the youth's shoulder, right? Especially if you think about the long term. We'll be there, well, I'm going to be your grandfather. They're nice people, but they won't be there.
The youth haven't seen as much yet, so they don't think they know as much, so it's easier to change their mind. That's what I've seen from my generation.
See, it's a bit like what we'll see in that situation with Jean-Baptiste Colbert, because Colbert was in charge of a very young king, right? Louis XIV, who actually was the king at 5 years old. But Colbert came in when the king was 23. And Louis XIV is known for this. He learned French today. La folie des grandeurs.
Megalomania. The big folly, what?
Maybe you saw that word in English. Grandeur. No. It's when you really like, it's like, I think we say, like megalomania. Like you have the folly of grandeur.
Visions of grandeur.
Yeah. Because Louis XIV was not he's not a humanist, right? He's a man who got caught in many wars. And the key thing with Colbert, because just to go back a little bit, LaRouche is defending a certain system of economics. And we talk about environmentalism as showing some problems, sometimes some pretty deep ones. But right now, what we're pushing is a solution, right? Because if you have this fascist movement spreading, that people financing dictatorships or financing military interventions, bombing nations and stuff like that, your solution does not reside in a document that shows who's bad. Right? It's okay, and because just by looking at how the population is behaving right now, knowing someone is bad does not make someone react necessarily towards stopping that bad person. If you think about a situation where you have war, and you have two nations torn one against the other, there's very few chances that these two are going to start talking, like suddenly. I'm pissed if I know war. Let's see what these guys are thinking. It doesn't happen like that. Or if you just look at today, with the economic situation, right, if you think about people looking for a job, there's not an idea of like wanting to harm the other guy looking for the same job. But there's certainly this idea that I gotta get this job. I gotta, whatever it takes, I need money. Not because they like the job, it's very seldom the case that they like their job, but they need money. And it's at that point where human beings are, because of the situation, they're forced sometimes to do something which is not in their nature. Right? To do something which they don't feel good. And you had the same case in the 30s. We have a big depression. I read some of these people reporting back in that time. Right? The guy named Tommy Douglas was a Canadian politician. He would talk about how people would go see their priest and feeling very shitty and ask for clothes because they were dressing their kids with, whatever they could find, like potato bags or whatever, because they had nothing. Right? Or taking, you have to wash yourself with dirty water. There's at a certain point to survive, you have to adopt a certain cheap behavior and you don't like it. You feel pretty cheap. That tends to degrade the quality of human beings. Right? And at a certain point you can realize that you can go to certain extremes. Like you have these kamikaze people ready to kill themselves. If you think about the example that Bruce mentioned many times about the Dark Age, we have this black plague. Yeah, people were behaving and say, oh my God, God is mad. So let's have a party, right? So let's make sure that we party as much as possible for the next 20 minutes. Who cares? Let's just party. And yet these other people would say, oh shit, God is mad. So maybe if I'm very mad at myself, God will stop being mad at us. So they start whipping themselves, right? They go street, like city to city. They spread even more the disease. These guys are so like, they got so scared not knowing what was going on. Right? Like if you have a financial crash, I mean, people are not like, oh my God, it was a financial crash. It must be because of Dow Jones, right? They don't have like a whole idea what happened. They just know something happened. They say, what do I do? What do I do? Right? So you need actually, right now, you have a population which is losing a bit with what's going on. Right? The situation is getting tough. So at a certain point, you have these people who are going to bring a certain idea of a reason. Say, well, okay, let's not panic. Okay, we have a plan. Let's talk about it. Let's see what we can do about that. That's a bit of our role. But Bag actually is a bit of that, right? He has this, he was actually the advisor of a Colbert, of a Louis XIV when Colbert was about his 40s, like 42. But before that, he had worked a lot with people like Cardinal Mazarin. I'm going to talk about later at the end. But Colbert for sure is what we would call an historical individual. Not because he died. You don't have to die to be historical. Right? It's not like your history now.
but most historical people are dead.
Exactly. People like Martin Luther King. Right? But the question is, and I think this we should... You should keep that in your mind as a question, and we can talk about it after that. But can you be alive and historical? Like, okay, you might die. That's true. We're all gonna die. We might be shot. We might die of a flu. I don't know. But with the destruction of the infrastructure, your healthcare is going out. You might die of flu one day. So. But can you be alive? Can you act as an historical person? Historical individual. Okay. So Colbert. LaRouche talked a lot about Colbert when he's talking about his so-called economic system, the American system of political economy. But it wasn't the only one. You had people like Alexander Hamilton, who I'm going to read a quote, who refers to Colbert as one of the key elements for the development of the United States as an engine towards development of human beings. Right? Very short. So he says, that's from Hamilton. Yeah, and Hamilton was the first Treasury Secretary of the United States. The man who wrote extensively about manufacture and also system of credit. But, and also, the people don't think he's just as we say in French, a pen pusher, right, just writing stuff. He was also a colonel, under General Washington, at the time of the American Revolution. And that was, you know, in 1782. I guess he was pretty young at that time. I mean, it's one of these guys that during the American Revolution when we were awfully young, like Lafayette was 19 or 20, they were fighting this American Revolution. So Hamilton said in an article in a newspaper called New York Packet, he said, "Trade may be said to have taken its rise in England under the auspices of Elizabeth, and its rapid progress there is in a great measure to be ascribed to the fostering care of government in that and succeeding reigns. From a different spirit in the government with superior advantages, France was much later in commercial improvements. Nor would her trade have been at this time in so prosperous a condition had it not been for the abilities and indefatigable endeavors of the great Colbert. He laid the foundation of the French commerce and taught the way to his successors to enlarge and improve it. The establishment of the woolen manufacture in a kingdom where nature seemed to have denied the means, is one among many proof how much may be effected in favor of commerce by the attention and patronage of a wise administration. The number of useful edicts passed by Louis XIV, and since his time, in spite of frequent interruptions from the jealous enmity of Great Britain, has advanced that of France to a degree which has excited the envy and astonishment of its neighbors. Because you're, and I'm going to talk more about that later, France is, see, France had its own French Revolution, 1789, that actually was a failure in terms of principle. It was a revolution, but not the one that they were really looking for. More like a mobbish revolution. But France has, still has, you have to dig, but it's still there. They have a certain tradition towards the development of human beings, right, the development of mankind, despite the so-called kingdom, right, because maybe if you remember your history class, a king is supposed to represent God, right, God, the king, and the mob, right, and Colbert, in, because I went to the library to get these old books, like 1694, which is a political testament of Colbert. And in which there's a little part, there's a little chapter where he tried to explain to the king why he should look to be loved for his, by his people. And he starts by putting a pretty big paradox to the king. He says, well, king, do you know why they chose you? Well, isn't the king supposed to be chosen by God? Then the king is like, okay. But then he says, think about it, God. Before French kings, right, during the La Gaule, what they would call Gaul, G-A-U-L, right? Well, there was no king. Yeah, there were some generals, right? Because they were waging wars against the Romans, but there was no king. So at a certain point, what happens is that the population decided to choose one of those guys. Make sure that they would lead the population. Because they had a certain advantage. Not a godlike advantage, but an advantage. And from that point on, he's really emphasizing to the king, look, buddy, you've been chosen for a very good reason. You have stuff that other people don't. And you have to make sure that you give everyone you have to the other people. You develop them. Then he goes into a series of stuff that Louis XIV signed on, right, in terms of, I'll go through a bit of that, but giving a lot of money to the population in terms of for their own development. Then he says, well, this is a very nice thing that you did, King, but it's what everyone should have done. Is that you have to do it even more, because you were chosen by these people.
Louis XIV is Louis XIV.
Yeah. Louis XIV.
Or also known as the Sun.
Yeah, he reigned for like one hell of a time.
Don't.
He was there for a very long time.
Can you speak to it was five?
Yeah, I mean, everyone died at a time.
So. Five to that.
Okay, exactly how, but, I mean, of course he doesn't decide of everything. He's surrounded by advisors. Right? But,
like George Bush.
Yeah. That's my other point, because I want to read some, very quickly, I'm going to read some Rabelais, in which, give you a sense of, I mean, Rabelais is a lot before. It's like, this book I'm gonna go is like 1550 something. So it's like 100 years before. It'll give you a little of a sense because, at the same time that France is developing, you also have this tradition of, so-called Greater France, right? That you want France to be the empire, right? Let's take over, take over a lot of things. Maybe not the world, but. Okay. And, yeah, because in this, Rabelais, people know Rabelais? You heard, you know François Rabelais? The bell?
Somebody in case you know.
So, François Rabelais?
Rabelais? Did you just say that? The dirtiest priest or whatever?
Well, actually, it's there's a. We're not going to go into too much of Rabelais. Actually, I'm going to give one quote, maybe a second one at the end. But there's a necessity at that time to fight against an enormous backwardness in the church, to drive human beings toward, you know, shit. Right? If you want to be loved by God, you better hate anything that has to do with the physical reality, buddy. Right? So don't spend too much time cleaning yourself. Right? Don't
have
eat.
Have a lot of kids.
Feel self-flagellation.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the usual stuff that we had in Quebec or whatever. And Rabelais is writing against that in order to kind of wake up the population, right? Bring this idea of what human beings really are. Also, he has to get people to laugh a bit about these poor fellows that think they're so mighty. Actually, they're like you see with Colbert, that he's making fun a lot about the church. So, but in this chapter, the thing that what happens that you have a war which is being triggered, sometimes like such a lousy excuse. You have this fight among people making cakes of a certain country, and the people under a Grand Gousier, who is the like the good king in the story, is also a giant, right? And like this just like nagging story, and it's waging a war. The Grand Gousier tries to calm things down, you know, writing letters, sending ambassadors. Shit, no war, come on, we don't need that. And Picrocole was the, Picrocole is the king, crazy king. But he's in that chapter, he's being discussing with some of his advisors. And this will give you a good sense of what Colbert had to deal with.
Picrocole? And he's the one discussing with his advisors?
Yeah.
Is that an English
one? Yeah,
well,
yeah. That's a house. But some people might say it's that what I'm going to do is heresy, because it's in English. But because you miss a lot in the translation.
I was waiting for you to like burn it or something.
No, I'm going to read it, which might be useful.
Read it in English.
No, that's going to be... Okay, so chapter 33. How certain of Pricocole's advisors, by their headstrong counsel, put him in extreme peril. Okay, the cakes haven't been unloaded, right? So they were trying to sell an agreement before with the cakes. They brought back the cakes, trying to help.
You saying cakes or cakes?
Cakes. Like,
cake.
Okay, the cakes haven't been unloaded. They're appeared before Pricocole. Picrocole, the Duke of Checkout, Earl Swashbuckler, and Captain Dongby, who said to him, "Sir, today we make you the happiest and most chivalrous prince that ever was since the death of Alexander of Macedon." "Cover yourself, put on your hat," said Picrocole. We thank you," they said. "Sir, we offer you our humble duty. This is the plan. You will leave here some captain in garrison with a small company of men to hold the place, which seems to us fairly strong, both by nature and by the ramparts of your devising. You will divide your army into two parts, as you well know how to do. One division will go and fall on this Grand Gousier and his men, and then they will easily overthrow him at the first attack. There you will gain money by the pile, for the scoundrel has enough and to spare. Scoundrel, we call him because no noble prince ever has a penny. To hoard a treasure is the mark of a scoundrel. Meanwhile, the other division will make for Onis, Saint-Onge, Angoumois, and Gascony, also for Périgord, Médoc, and Delambre. Cities, castle, and fortress will fall to them without resistance. At Bayonne, Saint-Jean-de-Luz, and Fuenterrabia, he will seize all the shipping. And coasting towards Galicia and Portugal, you will pillage every seaboard town as far as Lisbon, where you will get all the reinforcement necessary for a conqueror. Spain will surrender, by God, for the Spaniards are a lazy bunch. You will cross the Strait of Seville, and there you will erect two columns, grander than the columns of Hercules, as a perpetual memorial to your name. This strait shall be called the Picrocolin Sea. Then you have passed the Picrocolin C, Barbarossa himself will yield himself as your slave. I shall grant him free pardon, said Picrocolin. That is, said they, provided that he accept baptism. Then he will storm the kingdoms of Tunis, Hippo, Alger, Bonn, Cyrene, and in fact all Barbary. Advancing further, you will lay your hands upon Majorca, Minorca, Sardinia, Corsica, and other islands of the Ligurian and Balearic Seas. Coasting to the left, you will subdue all Gallia, Narbonensis, Provence, and the Allobrogians, Genoa, Florence, and Lucca. It will be all up with Rome. Poor Master Pope is already dying of fear. I'll never kiss his slipper, I promise you, said Picrocolin. With Italy taken, there is Naples, Calabria, Apulia, and Sicily all to be sacked, and Malta too. I only hope those jolly knights, once of road, will resist you, so that we can see what they're made of. I should like to go to Loreto, said Picrocolin. No, impossible, they said. That will be on your return. From there, we will take Crete, Cyprus, Rhodes, and the Cyclades, and attack the Morea. It's ours. By St. Trinian, may the Lord preserve Jerusalem, for the Sultan's power is not comparable with yours. Then, said Picrocolin, I'll have Solomon's temple rebuilt. Not yet, they said. Wait a little. You must never be too precipitate in your decisions. Do you know what Octavian Augustus said? Festina lente, which means more haste, less speed. It will be better for you first to conquer Asia Minor, Caria, Lycia, Pamphylia, Sicilia, Lydia, Phrygia, Mysia, Bithynia, Charazia, Adalia, Samagaria, Castamina, Luga, and Sebaste, all as far as the Euphrates. And he goes on for another page. and then there's the Colbert part. Okay? Among those present was an old nobleman named Esephron, a hardened warrior who had stood the test of many dangerous situations. And when he heard this speech, he said, I'm very much afraid that all this enterprise will be like the farce of the pitcher of milk with which a shoemaker made his fortune in his daydreams. But when the pitcher was broken, he hadn't enough to buy a dinner. What are you after with these fine conquests of yours? What will be the end of all these labors and journeying? The end will be, said Picrocolin, that when we're back, we shall rest at our ease. Then said Esephron, but suppose that you should never return from there, for the journey is long and perilous. Would it be better for us to take our ease now, and not run into all these dangers? Oh, said Swashbuckler, here's a fine dreamer, by God. Let's go and hide them in the chimney corner, and pass our lives there with the ladies, and spend our time threading beads or spinning like Sardanapalus. The man who ventures nothing wins neither horse nor mule, as Solomon said. The man who ventures too much loses both horse and mule, as Malcolm answered, replied Esephron. Enough, said Picrocolin. Let's go on. I fear nothing except these devilish legions of Grand Gousiers. Supposing that while we are in Mesopotamia, they were to strike our rear, what remedy should we have? A very good one, said Dungy. A nice little order that you will send to the Muscovites will immediately put into field for you 450,000 picked fighters. Oh, if you make me your lieutenant, I will kill a comfort peddler. I bite, I charge, I strike, I seize, I slay, I stop at nothing. On, said Picrocolin. Let everybody be got ready. Let him that loves me follow. Right? And Louis XIV actually embodied that for many times, despite people like Esephron or Colbert, in our case. So this shows that you have to think this is 100 years before. So already in France, you have people like Rabelais, who were also working with François I, who was the king at the time, and so as advising him. So Colbert was part of a tradition of not only people of want to do good, but they also had a certain scientific approach to doing good. Because Colbert was the first thing that he did, right? which was pretty bold at the time, was to say, okay, so who is looting the king? Who's messing with the taxes? And you had a guy at the time named, it was the Minister of Finance named Fouquet, F-O-U. I just raised that. I think it was Nicolas, I'm not sure. Who was the Minister of Finance? Right? One of the first things that Colbert goes after is this guy. Because the guy is somehow with different schemes. And if you go to France, there's an enormous castle. I think it's called Chateau de Vauban. It was actually enormous, but which was built through the looting of the king. Right? By using all the taxation that he sucked. And during certain years, the looting was so dense that actually less than half the money of taxations would make it to the castle, make it back to the king. Right? So that was as bad as it was. And Colbert, by going through different investigations and different actions, actually he found himself caught to fight about 40,000 different noble families. 40,000 families were involved into that. Right? So you can imagine that if you do that, you're not really welcome. Because, you know, as we saw in Rabelais and what happened through history, I mean, Louis XIV, as a very young kid, was advised by different things, and pretty evil ones, and people were actually partaking in what was going on through the looting and taxation. So Colbert starts by finding himself with a lot of enemies, but still keep pretty pushing what he's doing. And there's a... So there's this thing we call here in Quebec. It's called the revenge of the cradle. Attends ça, la revanche des berceaux. Okay. It refers to this time where people would like make babies like rabbits.
Yeah. Maybe call it.
No, actually, it was for a purpose of. Well, see the thing about it, when you have the Dark Age, you have a plague, so European population shrinks like two-thirds or something like that. Yeah. So you need people.
I need babies.
So you need to make a lot of babies, because Colbert was one of the main responsible at a certain point for the colonization of the Americas, Nouvelle France. He's the one who sent Jean Talon. Well, not quite. Jean Talon was sent by some guy, I forget his name, and then Colbert was the guy right after, was taking care of all the colonies. To populate it, but to develop it economically, of course. And actually, you had the same phenomenon in France, which, right, first what you get is that, well, you need babies, so... Whoever makes babies or gets married very quick, you're gonna be tax relieved. So if you get married before the rule was if you get married before you're 20, you have no taxation for 5 years. Get married at 21, 4 years.
That reminds me of John Howard, our prime minister. He's giving out government grants for women having babies.
Okay. Yeah.
Because
we're too underpopulated.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, you guys are 17.
What the baby burners?
Baby burners. So, and also if you have like a certain amount of kids, you're going to get grants or something like that. Stuff like that. And in about something like 20 years, France population triples. It's pretty good. It goes from 7 to 21 million people. But of course, it's not just... Right, let's make babies. You need a certain way of developing these people. And that's when there's a very strong link with Lerouge, because when you ask yourself, where does wealth come from? It's come from God, from the soil. Right? Like, if you remember Hamilton's quote where he says, France developed a woolen manufacture, but the land that they were on did not really allow for that. And that's one of the first, it's one of the things that Colbert calls in his political testament. He says, King, we'll need to finance the purchase of a sheep and horses. So then he says, well, if we have about 6 million of them, then we should be fine. So you're talking about an enormous sum. To be able to develop the land properly, because it's the one thing that was lacking at the time. And then he adds, he says, well, okay, it's very nice to have horses and sheep. But if you don't have anyone behind that, you have human beings, actually have what it takes to develop. If they don't get a tax relief, they're not going to make it. And this is more important than anything else. This is the key, the food, right? The agriculture. So this is key for a kingdom. It's absolutely necessary. Right? So Louis XIV being, I guess, influenced by a good thing sometimes, would emit this enormous sum of money for development, despite his craziness. Because Colbert, after his fight against Fouquet, really become a popular hero, right? Because you're in a situation where what Colbert was doing had been talked about before, but like some type of dream, you know? Like when we show the Eurasian land bridge, right? We say, well, this is what we're planning to do for the next 50 years. Yeah, really. Nice dream, buddy. Have a beer. Forget about this dream. Right? Uh-huh? No, that's what some people say. They don't have the beer because they're cheap. Say, go get a glass of water.
In your face.
So there's this intent to develop not just the land, but actually human beings, right? Your manufacturing. And Colbert was really key on that, right? Because you're at a time where, right before Colbert, what happens is that people like Mazarin, Cardinal Mazarin, managed to take out all these tolls, right, that was inside France. Remember when LaRouche talked about this idea of efficiency, that if you have a road with a toll, actually the time you waste with that toll, if you go like in New York, if you go down on the 87, there's a lot of tolls and it's always like jam-packed. The time you're wasting actually is going to cost you more than all the money you're going to make in your toll. The problem is that France is very divided, right? You have all these little lords, the Taliban type of lords, they can make some money out of commerce. So when you go from one side of France to the other, I mean, your piece of wool, for example, would cost you like an impossible price. So Mazarin managed to get rid of that, but that's Colbert who brought the actual tariff around France, saying that, okay, we need to develop our own manufacturing. Too bad if these guys are making good wool, we need to produce our own, right? Too bad if, let's for example, we had this question of horses, right? In a situation where we don't have any cars, so horses are key in your commerce as well, like your boat, your ships. So he says, well, forget about buying a horse from the Germans, or I think it was the Swiss, where the good development of horses. Bring these horses in once, and then they just breed them. Right? We'll have our own knowledge of horses, and we'll develop that. Same thing with ships. You know, Colbert was the guy who managed, Pascal could have gotten more into that, but... So what happened before Colbert is that France lost most of its fleet. They had like 20, it's called galère, I forget the name in English. Galère? A huge boat.
Galeons?
G-A-L-L-E-O-N?
Galeons are huge flag.
Okay, galeons.
In which country you're in? It's spelling a different pronunciation.
No, it's not the same spelling, but galère. So he had 20 of these enormous ships, like warships, and he had another fleet of different boats of about maybe 50 or something, like very small numbers. This was mainly destroyed after a certain popular revolt called the Fronde, which I can't really go into, which was mentioned a few times by LaRouche, though, as an example of major destabilization of the French kingdom, which led to the Treaty of Paris, 1763, a while after. But Colbert managed to develop this fleet, like you're talking about thousands of boats that they managed to build. But the key thing is that they also find a different way to build these boats. And Pascal made this comment, he said, it's like an IKEA boat. Right? And they would even make these contests among cities, like boat, like ship builders. See how long it would take. And yet like one region would build it like in 30 hours. The other one like 20. And Toulouse, and in Toulouse they made it in 7 hours. Right? And you're talking about like ships, like not a little also, they need your like it's a boat. The boat can bring a lot of food and shit. Right? So in 7 hours, so talking about like it's a big revolution. Right?
That's average when they make the light, or
that's like the fastest time you could take to build a boat.
Skill?
How big are these boats?
Well, like think about a
That's a miniature model.
Yeah, it's not like it's boats for your trade. You can imagine it's pretty big.
Got to carry your goods.
150
long. Yeah.
It can be up to 70 meters
long. That's pretty big.
And they don't have a power industrial machine electronic.
They don't have anything.
Well, yeah, they might have certain machines.
They would have water-powered swords, right?
Well, look, it's like if you have a space program, if you have a usually a project, like a national project, you have a government that's gonna make offers. Okay, here's what we offer. We have to build this. So who owns the contract? And then you have these guys, these so-called entrepreneurs, like LaRouche is talking about. These guys that are fomenting creativity in society because they're trying to find different ways to produce. And they say, okay, well, we can build your thing in, you know, such amount of time, such amount of money because we have this method. So you have this, like it's like a sane competition among cities or among regions. Trying to find, you know, the best way to build it. In a sense, who cares if you lose? I mean, if a nation was triggered towards finding the best method possible, thereafter that you have it, this method. Say, okay, let's use it, let's study that, and let's build like hell. Let's build for the kingdom of France. Okay. Nope. And also one thing that Colbert managed to do, which is also a pretty big breakthrough, is on this term of wages. Right? That you're in a situation, you know, you can imagine 16th century France, and then you have this Colbert guy who says, there's a few projects we need to do, and we have to give, you know, have to make sure we have the best, workforce as possible. Then that first time you had actually like a union type of approach toward your workforce, that it has certain requirements, right? Like you saw, if you look, for example, it's not the same idea, but well, it is the same idea, just in the same time. But if you look at a place where they build cathedrals, you always have houses right beside or close to that were built for the workers. The workers would stay there, right? They have a nice house for family and stuff. Well, not a house, but a big apartment, like you have in France. But they could stay there, but also that it was, these cathedrals were usually a pretty big, a challenge, a very, very big, infrastructural task, architectural task. They figure out a lot of different breakthroughs in order to build a cathedral. One of the projects that Colbert was known for, put it down, not because he built it himself, but think about this question of the historical individual, or what LaRouche referred many times, people like John F. Kennedy. I mean, John F. Kennedy was not like a big engineer. Was not a, didn't study a space technology. But he's the one who started the whole space program. Not because he was the best knowledgeable about that, but because he knew that this has to be done, and he had to trigger a certain passion in the population, try to figure out all these, to solve all these problems, the paradoxes that were there. I lack a bit of logistics in the sense of a map and stuff. I have a few maps, but I mean it's not that big of a deal anyway. But you see this project, Canal du Midi, also known as Canal du Languedoc, or let's keep it for the Midi. See, this actually led to the creation of the biggest artificial lake ever made. That is in France right now. It's, ever.
What do you mean by artificial lake?
Well, like if you have a hole.
Oh, like a dam? Hold on. I have different. Lake. Yeah, I mean a lake is only an artificial
lake. Man-made dam?
Yeah, man-made.
Like
Lander. So they just dug a hole and then brought all this water and transported it.
Well, what happens is you have like a big open area. And you redirect water into that big, like, cup type area, and then it fills up.
That's called a dam.
Oh, a dam's different.
Well, the thing, yeah, this lake, like, it's a
big body of
water. Around 6 million cubic meter of water. But the challenge was still to improve, it was to improve your economy, right? And, yeah, right there. People. No, a picture of the what was required to do. Maybe we can just show that to people. Cause I just have only one, unfortunately. But it's just to give you a sense. The white line shows the path that the boat the ship had to do to get to the other side of France. And the dark one is what actually they made. Be able to improve quite significantly trade. So you went from actually a road of a seaway of 3,000 kilometers, and they managed to shrink it to 240. Right?
It's good sale.
It's pretty good.
What's that? Wow.
Like the white path was 3 kilometers.
3,000.
And after the Canal du Midi, to go to the same place, that's what you had to do. But also, you see, if you look at the lower part of Spain, you have what's called the Gibraltar Strait. So every boat has to go from there. And of course, you're caught with enormous tolls by Spain, because they own the place. It's like, okay, you want to pass, fine, give me the money. You have pirates that are there. And of course, you can think of, there's a limited amount of things you can bring, and it's like if you just have one road to go someplace, it's fucking long at the same time. At some point, just not efficient. And the problem was that if you look, there's another drawing in this document. You have that sheet, you have that drawing on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, those two. Because you have basically
it's going to be a cheap drawing, but
that's from you
have different cities here.
That seems like from the site, not from the top, but the elevation, right? And you're kind of in a situation where your water, this water here flows from there, goes to the ocean, 10 feet also. And here it's kind of cut, and you have water going that way.
So you're.
But you would like to go from there, but you just can't. Right? And the problem is that you have water.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't go from like the top there down here.
Yeah.
Pull it around.
Yeah, like from there to there, it's 3,000 kilometers. Actually, yeah, because you have to. Like it's like Canada, right? You want to go to Vancouver by bus, it's 3 days. If you have a supersonic plane, it's like 3 hours. So it kind of improves your economy. It improves the flow of people, food, right? And he had a name because he had a certain scientist called Pierre-Paul Riquet, who always was fascinated by that problem. Because the thing is that you can't just say, okay, we're gonna dig a hole and the water is gonna get there. You need a lot more water. You need boats, you need ships to go there. So what they needed was to find another source of water in a very deserted area. And of course, you had this enormous problem. Well, how the hell are you gonna, okay, you can have maybe boats go, but the other side is a bit different. Right? So Pierre-Paul Riquet managed, that's what I mean by an artificial lake. I don't know exactly how they did it, but he needed to find a source somewhere. To find a source of water somewhere. And after he had found that source, which was very hard to see, you actually had to somehow make it flow and making sure you could connect, right? And that's when he brought, because I don't want to, it's hard to explain that by just telling it
to the board. So they have a board.
Huh?
So they have a board marker.
Yeah, but you see, it's like when you want people to read, get it. It's like you can say like the answer, right? Here's the answer. Meaning of life is, but it doesn't read. No, I don't know that. Yeah, I'm not quite clear on that. But in terms of this, which is a bit easier to comprehend, the meaning of life. At first, you had to find water. Water wasn't there. So the only way that they really found water was that you had certain underground rivers that were there, which necessitated enormous amount of digging, right? These rivers were a few kilometers away, so they had to be brought in an artificial lake that would then funnel the water in this channel. And so you have this enormous lake, enormous. And actually, Riquet managed to make sure the water, by flowing, right, look from the top of your lake, it's flowing towards your river. And just by putting some type of wall here, he managed to get the water to flow both sides equally. Mm. And of course, yeah, he added a little passage here for boats. Right. Then you had solved the problem. Well, actually, part of the problem. Because then you had to build 63 locks. Ecus? Locks? To manage to get the boat through, people might have seen how it works, right? We have a kind of a different. You have your boat, right? So by bringing down a wall, you will get the water coming in, lifting the boat. Like a type of stair, water stairs, if you want. It takes a while. It would take a while. Like, people working at these logs were, they had like, pretty good wages, because it was a shitty job. So you would manage to get the boat through the elevation. But that's one thing, you see, because, Colbert is the guy who, 1669, founded the Royal Academy of Science. Some of these names might sound familiar to you, because as Colbert did with certain of these projects, was to look for the best workforce possible. Same thing with science. You don't want to... And at that point, Colbert says, okay, well, let's look what's outside. You know. Well, I mean, Colbert is already, he's already in different talks with other nations in the scientific development. One of the first things that he does is to get, okay, let's find a president for that. And the president is Christian Huygens from Holland. Right? And you have other people who worked in the French Royal Academy of Science. People like Leibniz, and also Pierre de Fermat, who was a very good friend of Colbert, was also, and I found what I was looking for, was a counselor in the city of Toulouse. As I said before, you know, Toulouse is the city that built these boats like awfully quickly. But Toulouse was like one of the main centers. So being a counselor in Toulouse, it's right. When people talk about scientists just pushing their pens and looking at the stars and whatever. These people were directly involved in the development of France, but the development of there was a lot of, that's at that time where, for example, Fermat made some breakthroughs around the light, the light experiments. And Leibniz developed a certain, yeah, I'll give you the quote that Chaikin is giving around that. That he wrote a very small article. Yeah, Chaikin is one of our historians, by the way. So he wrote a little article on that. Okay, so it's 66, no mistake. So it's very, very short. In 1666, Colbert organized the French Academy of Sciences. He brought in the Dutch astronomer Christian Huygens as the Academy's president. The scientists working and studying under Colbert's sponsorship formed the core of leadership in the development of mathematics, physics, and chemistry for the next three centuries. Colbert's protégé, Denis Papin, was assigned to study under Huygens, as was the young German, J.W. Leibniz. Papin and Leibniz collaborated to develop the first working steamboat. Unfortunately, Papin and his model boat ended up in the hands of the British establishment, which managed to suppress steam power for another century. Huygens, the founder of the wave theory of light, taught mathematics to Leibniz, and in 1675, Leibniz completed the groundwork for his invention of the calculus, foundation of all modern mathematics. In 1675, Leibniz demonstrated his new calculating machine to the French Academy. It could multiply, divide, and take square and cube roots. He received three orders for the machine, one for the king, one for the Royal Observatory, and one for Minister of Finance, Colbert. Leibniz's pioneering work in the science of thermodynamics, the study of the potential of violent force to be tamed and put to use by men, was up and advanced a century later by Lazare and Sadi Carnot in the École Polytechnique, which later taught engineering to the American military. I think that's where it links to the United States. Because not just as Lazare Carnot, not Lazare Carnot, but Hamilton said, right? He says, well, Without Colbert, France would be nothing, right? If you think now in terms of where does Colbert comes from, right? See, a lot of people, they ask us about LaRouche. They say, well, okay, yeah, nice, good land bridge, but who's LaRouche? Who's that guy? And myself, sometimes I answer, I say, well, he's one of those very few historical individuals who will say, oh, also he's dead. Well, no. He's actually very alive. And as he says himself, he's, how do you say, frisky? Frisky? He's like 84.
So.
83. He's got the olden day version of the
okay.
Writing.
Okay. But if you just ask, if you take from Colbert, for example, right? People here maybe have seen quickly the development of France, right? One of the first people maybe we could go at without going back too far, but if you look at people like Joan of Arc, who managed basically save France from the British up to a certain time, which set the foundations for stuff like the Council of Florence, right, which was brought by Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa. We allow the Council of Florence being a dialogue among religions, right? But also that Joan of Arc had established that that sovereignty of a nation was key. You had to protect your nation, right? And then you get a situation where you have a bit later people like Henry IV. This is important because Henry IV is the one who put the basis for the Treaty of Westphalia. He's the man. Along with Duc de Sully, Henry IV, and his longtime friend, Duc de Sully, gradually both of these guys developed this concept of the advantage of the other, which is a bit more tricky than people might think of. It's not a... See, it's a... It's like one of these principles that you can't just do half, you can't just go partially. Because it's really not about a mutual agreement. Forget like mutual agreement. Let's make sure that everything is nice for you and me. It's really this idea, okay, what's good for you? What is the advantage of the other fully, completely? And you start from that standpoint, right? So you, and it's a bit what's being asked of the population today, right? Forget about, I need to pay this bill, or I need to do that, or how about me? Well, that won't work. There's no solution right now which can be based on try to please everyone. But there's this idea, okay, let's see what the others are needed. Because France was always at that time was a bit on a higher level in terms of economics, in terms of its development. So it was one of those nations that had to give a lot to the others, and not the opposite, right? If you're filthy rich, you don't say, well, what's for me? You say, well, what's for the others? And one of the first things that Duc de Sully said to Henry IV, he said, hey, nice concept. So how about you put in it, how about you make it concrete? Because it's not about, see, we're not a movement just like Sully is, right? It says, you, Henry IV, has to do it. It's a very nice idea, but it's not going to be done by anyone else, right? So we're not, like, in this movement, is not looking for some type of super leader that's hiding somewhere. Maybe this deputy from Oshawa will lead the fight, right? Or maybe that guy from the CW has actually a lot of passion and will fight for the... You don't get that. Yeah. So Henry IV had actually to put that into make it concrete. And one of the problems that Henry IV had is that he was a Protestant with the majority. He was a Protestant leading a majority of Catholics. So you can imagine that the financier circles at the time were pretty happy. And that's easy to manipulate. So Henry IV says, "Okay, I'll convert." Big freak out. Financiers freaks out. But, see, you have already this idea of the advantage of the other. Okay, well, I'll do what's good for my population. That's I'm Protestant and I will stay, and that's the way it has to be. I've been Protestant for 40 years. I'm not gonna change now. Baby boomer. So yeah, this time, and Henry IV tried to go against the bad, like what Colbert did. Try to go against the crazy people looting the kingdom. We didn't manage. He got stabbed. And then after that, he had the period with Ferdinand de Mazarin, who's the one who made concrete the Treaty of Westphalia. But never forget that, well, first, the Treaty of Westphalia is a huge piece of, you have one page which is good. The rest, it's all, Well, no, it's this idea of right. If you have Switzerland, I know you're gonna give them. Okay, we give you this part of land just to calm you down a little bit. We will give you such amount of money. We'll take out this or that. There's a lot of like
mechanics of that.
Yeah. Well, it's more like arbitrary stuff that you give out just to keep people quiet. But the main thing is on these, you have these two first principles, which says, forget about revenge, right? This horrendous religious war, we're not going to find a culprit. And we have to go towards this advantage of the other, right? But, I mean, you're talking about, like more than 20 years of, diplomacy there, right? Yeah, it was included like 14 kingdoms. And he had enormous changes, right? Mazarin is the one who brought, as a saying, he brought the end of tolls in France and Germany, because, you know, he was trying to help these guys out. And certain projects that he did were also directed towards Germany mainly, built by French expertise, right? And Colbert, at a very young age, was an advisor to Mazarin in his 20s. From where I think he developed a certain understanding of himself being part, not just of a certain family, but also part of a certain tradition, which didn't start with himself, right? In a situation where these ideas are there, but there's a lack of, maybe a lack of understanding, but there's very few people able to apply these ideas. It's like, okay, we'll do it. Who's going to take the heat? And Colbert says, well, for my kingdom, no, for my king, but for France, no, for the development of the people, yeah, I'll take that in charge. I'll lead the king, despite all these freaked out people want to go from Paris to Beijing and invade everything. Gotta make sure the king goes in the right way and that he understands the need of the population. Right? Then if you think about today, if you think about LaRouche, what he represents, right? Because Colbert, was basically put the basis, right? As he mentioned a little bit, as Chaikin mentioned, right? We have this Academy of Science where the greatest minds are working, people like Leibniz, who influence, this whole idea of, this whole concept around, what's in the American Constitution, the pursuit of happiness. We have this enormous fight against John Locke. The guy brought this idea that, you know, it's not life, liberty, and happiness, it's life, liberty, and property. And human beings, you know, they're looking for, you know, avoiding pain, looking for pleasures. That's how they deal with the world. Right? Also this idea of property, right? If you think at a time we have slave trade. So if you are property of someone, you are his property, so there's nothing much you can do. Right? And this was, you know, this was one of the main problems. So Leibniz attacked that in a book called The New Essays on the Understanding, on Human Understanding, which was only published after Leibniz had died, like 60 years after. You know, that's another subject. Also around in France, you had this École Polytechnique, right? Which actually is a basis for our own youth movement, in terms of education. At a time where France had to deal with a lot of enemies and they have to form enormous amount of scientists very quickly, to be able to educate the population and to develop whether the weapons or the things required, for war. Because France never had like enormous amount of raw materials, so they had to deal, right, with shit. So they had to find different ways to produce. And École Polytechnique, led by Lazare Carnot, Gaspard Monge, is the institution that developed scientific leadership, which allowed France to win a war around 1794. With people who were basically, they were called sans culottes. Which means like with no pants. That was the name of the French army. Sans culottes.
What?
Because they were so like poor, they had nothing. You didn't have enough stuff to make shoes for everyone.
Dang.
But with different inventions, like descriptive geometry, France was the first army to have weapon that you could dismantle and bring by little parts. So you get on the field. It takes like 1 minute to build your cannon, right? You can go with that. Also, the use of air balloons, Montgolfière, right? For military. And like you're talking a lot about two guys in a little basket. Think about like bringing horses and shit like that. Right?
Air balloon.
Yeah, air balloon.
Air balloon type thing.
Yeah, like right.
Oh.
All right, let's go. But that wasn't really used because they didn't find any chance to use it. But that was the plan. That was one of those ideas. And also the idea was of Carnot was to say, Carnot is another story, but one thing that he would do, which freaked out a lot of people, was to say, well, on two questions that he was asked during the time of war, he'd say, well, Mr. Carnot, there's a little problem here. We have no money, no food, no nothing. And, we have nothing. So what do we do? And then Carnot says, well, actually, this is our strength. So we have all the military and say, okay, let's get out of here, fuck. Right? and he says, what the hell are you talking about? Yeah, see, we're going to use our mobility. The fact that we're going to be a lot more mobile than these other guys, because these other guys, they have a shitload of stuff. Like for every soldier for the English army, he had like 20, no more than that, because he had servants.
Servants?
Yeah. Right? So yeah, you're talking about like something like between 50 and 100 pounds for each soldier in terms of material.
By their shape.
Right? Yeah. Don't be pretty to die. So, and then of course that's with these type of problems, right? It's like with the Canal du Midi, you have a problem that you want to solve. So you have to deal with that. You have to deal with a lack of something. And of course development of, let's say, descriptive geometry, building different types of weapons. And the other question that was asked, say, oh, Mr. Carnot, right, this enormous battle there which will decide everything, was a take some type of mount, I forgot. So who will you send, Mr. Carnot? It's easy, I'll send the youth. What do you mean? Yeah, the youth. Because you old farts, you can't think. You're cut in your old model where people are working at this. And, right? Right? You saw that in he says, no way I'm going to send you over there. We're going to lose big time. And of course, and not to say the least, Carnot was at the head of the army. He wasn't hiding in the back. He was there on the field. All these youths, right? And they, of course they won. Right? Because you had a certain passion, but also a certain innovation in the youth. It's like we have to develop today, right? And this École Polytechnique model is what was taken over, fortunately took over so-called West Point Academy in the United States, which was, as we said in different publications, which developed a better understanding of the military, but in terms of development, in terms of nation builders. And from which people like Edgar Allan Poe come from. People saw in different documents recently. Because you had this development in the United States, which allowed people like Hamilton, or let's say that allowed the United States to stay independent up to today. Right? Because, and that's a key point, after that, right after Lazare Carnot was there, you had something in France which was pretty bad. What happened after Napoleon?
Bonaparte,
right? And who was Napoleon's favorite mathematician? Right. So you had a very big switch, and École Polytechnique was taken over by a bunch of fundies, and I read a bit about that, but it was a while ago. But actually, the French École Polytechnique, like, changed completely, went towards, just as before you had youth working on a problem together, like 20 youth trying to figure out something about, you know, wind or water or steam, and then going into the cities and try to replicate that in people's mind. Right after that, this was exactly what they were aiming at, the process of discovery. Let's just write down like some type of formulas, just describe something, but let's not make it as an issue to be get it out. Like, if you think about a development of some type of scientific elite, instead of the opposite saying, let's get in the street and let's make sure that everyone knows how to build or to develop. Right? Because when you're in emergency, I mean, you don't need no elite. This is one of the fights we had once with a lady from the CAW. She says, well, you guys, the Russians, you're two scientists. People won't trust scientists. She says, well, that's exactly the problem. But we don't want them to trust scientists. We want them to be scientists. They have to become ones. Right? It's not about, like, trusting a guy. But if there's one people that has to be trusted, it's not out of a blinded faith.
Just because people dodge responsibility, especially since the boomer generation, people dodge responsibility. What is their role as a human being? Are they responsible for themselves?
Yeah.
Someone else is going to do it.
So in the United States, that's where you had basically the whole tradition that developed France around Colbert. What made Colbert actually right after that made the United States. And, you know, from Lincoln to Roosevelt, then you had a guy named Lyndon LaRouche, right, who actually embodies those ideas, transmitting them. And to make sure we transmit that, he says that what I represent, what Colbert represented, what Carnot represented, we're going to need youth that will represent the same thing. Actually, not a bunch of people running around and say, war is bad. Yeah, we know. But how can you replicate such historical individual? And how can we act right now, please, before we die, right, as a historical individual? How can we make sure that we have the proper changes right now so that, just like where you have a continuation of ideas of different fights, right? And then we're here today, well, what type of fight will we wage so that, in a sense, in the coming generations, these people will have something to rely on and say, okay, well, these guys, they made the path for us. Because I think, and I don't want to break anyone's bubble, but we're not here to look for some type of a government position like you. That's what's driving people. If that's what's driving people, well, we'll have a good chat in the kitchen. Well, look, it's we're in a situation where even before that, right, you need an action directly into the population. And that's what decides of who the leaders are. You can have an institutional leader that is actually a complete loser, complete failure. And that seems to be the model these days. But then someone has to do the job. For these events like DC, or the so-called cadre school, that's what you want to build. Not some people who have a back in, or a master in poli-sci or whatever. That's not the approach. You go from the standpoint of Colbert, Abdul-Rouge, right, who was, for example, the founder of the Fusion Energy Foundation. Right, in the 70s, he had an enormous network of scientists, some of the best in Europe and the United States, right? People who partook in the NASA project, people who were there during World War II, that were, like, there to develop these machines. In the time of war, but to make the breakthroughs in your economy. And then we're talking that fusion energy would be the basis for economy in 20 years, in 30 years. It was in the 70s. And yet, some people directly, like people like LaRouche, attacking spread or the development of fascism right after Roosevelt had died. Truman, the Cold War. developing a movement around those ideas. In 1976, Arouche proposed a debt moratorium for New York and Rome. Right? And then this is the idea picked up by the non-aligned movement in order for them to have a moratorium on their debt and to ask for the development that they definitely need. That was Arouche. Arouche was an advisor to Indira Gandhi. He worked with people like Fred Wills, who was Vienna's foreign minister. Developed this idea of an international development bank. Ran as a president for the United States. And developed this conception of economics that we're going to have to, that we have to transmit today, in terms of this idea of physical economy. So people like Colbert put on the basis for that. This was developed in Belarus on a high standpoint. And taking on this idea, the same type of change that you had after World War II, right? Threatened with the new economic system. So, now it's in our hand. It's going to be fun.